It's Tuesday, 18th of February, and it's time to get your grin on with the Grincast, here to discuss the world of gaming from the past week. I'm your host, Ace, and joining me is Nikki.
Hello.
But that's not all. We have two special guests from Treese Brothers Games. They are Andrew Treese and Corey Treese.
Hi, everybody. This is Andrew.
Hey, this is Corey. Thanks for having us on.
It's our pleasure. Welcome. We're going to be talking about their latest Kickstarter campaign, Cybernights Flashpoint, shortly. But first, as we always do, what's everyone been playing this past week? Nikki, why don't you start us off?
Yes, start with the person who will have the least to say. this is becoming a trend now, I'm afraid. I haven't really had much of a chance to play an awful lot over the last week. So the usual affair of Arknights and Azura Lane. Azura Lane, still just working through. There is, I believe, an event at the minute. I've not actually checked for like 2 days. But again, as I've explained multiple times, I use Azura Lane as a weird 10-minute sort of disconnect from everything else. I'll just load in, do the dailies, set up the automatic quests, go back to what I was doing, come back a few hours later. It's just a weird, like, it's one of those, it's that logic of I'm having a break from looking at a screen by looking at a smaller screen, which is scientifically proven to do nothing. So, whoops. I've still been playing Arknights, but not as much. I might uninstall it because, and I know we've spoken about it a little bit before, Ace, like the fact that it's a game, a mobile game you actually have to play, and it's, you know, tower defense. I really like the world. I love the character designs, but I'm just not feeling any urge to play it other than the fact that it's by the same people that made Azura Lane. So I don't know. I did, however, jump into Division 2 for like 20 minutes the other day because they announced a new expansion, which actually looks kind of awesome. I haven't played Division 2 since the week it came out, where I basically played it for 80 hours. So I kind of just jumped in, had a look at my agent, took a couple of pictures, and that was it. That's kind of, I remember what I was doing in Division 2 was just photography. But I
actually picked that up over the weekend because Ubisoft emailed me saying, oh, it's £2.50 at the moment. I thought, wait, it's an Epic exclusive, isn't it? Well, it's on Uplay as well. And Epic have a sale going on at the moment. Let me just go over to Epic. £2.49.
Wow.
A penny cheaper on Epic than it was on Uplay.
I mean, yeah, kind of petty.
Yeah, very petty.
Epic winning the battle one way or the other.
I'm constantly surprised at how Uplay prices are never cheaper than you can find anywhere else. Like Ghost Recon Wildlands, when that came out, I wanted to get it on release because I really enjoyed the betas, but it was like a tenner more expensive on Uplay than it was on Steam, and Steam didn't even have a special launch offer or anything.
Yeah, but it's, yeah, I do want to put time into it. I haven't played a loot and shoot in a while. I've not touched Destiny in like a month, and that's like, people, regular listeners will know, that's kind of my jam. Haven't done it. Just haven't really played much, apart from Dragon's Dogma, which was like 2 weeks ago. That's on the Switch, right next to me. Haven't touched it. I'm really bad at this whole gaming thing at the minute, but as is, you know, as is life. But, yeah. Well, speaking of Uplay, very quickly, Assassin's Creed Syndicate is apparently... No, not Uplay. Epic. Assassin's Creed Syndicate is apparently going to be the next, like, free game. And I've never played Syndicate, so I might jump into that for a little bit. I know it's nothing like Odyssey, and I love Odyssey, but it's London. London town.
My wife quite enjoys it. I haven't bought an Assassin's Creed game for myself, but I own three. Black Flag, Unity, I'm going to own Syndicate as soon as it comes out on Epic. Because Uplay keep giving the games away, and now Epic are giving the games away. But yeah, kind of a moot point because my wife has bought all of the games, so but still.
Yeah, and there's a couple of games coming to Game Pass that I might grab. I'm kind of in this weird dilemma where at the minute I'm spending quite a bit of time at work because it's quite busy. So I'm contemplating taking a console to work, and it'll probably be the Xbox, and I'll just use Game Pass, but we'll see.
Kingdom Hearts 3 coming to Game Pass.
Yeah, I've already played that. And you know how I feel about that. We're not even 10 minutes into the episode. Don't get me started.
Sorry.
That's fine. But yeah, that's really it for me. Sorry.
Okay. Myself, I've been playing Dauntless, Azur Lane, Simpsons Tapped Out, still going through that Black History Month event that they've got running. Star Trek Online, I'm playing that every day. You have to play 20 days and do the one of the daily tasks for 20 days to unlock a Klingon ship. So I'm at 17, I think. I've got a few more days of that. But I am working my way through the episodes. The way it's structured is you can play any available episode at any or available mission from any episode at any time. I'm forcing myself to go through it in release order. So that's it. Enlightening. Still playing a bit of Dead or Alive Venus Vacation, and I've been playing Azur Lane Crosswave. Playing it for review. It's 90% visual novel so far. I've sunk about 4 hours into the game. I've posted some gameplay up on the Game Green YouTube that you can check out. And yeah, it's get ready for a lot of reading and not much sailing around shooting things. The combat is very simplistic. Just go in circles, fire off torpedoes when they become available, and just fire your main weapon constantly while dodging enemy fire. So I'm hoping it gets a bit more complex, but I'm not holding out high hopes.
I'd love to be able to sit here and have a conversation with you about Azur Lane Crosswave, but after being sent an email saying my copy was going to be delivered yesterday, I have no idea where it is. Like I've spent about an hour today trying to find where the heck this package is. No one seems to know, and I don't even
hiding it from you at work.
Well, this is the thing. I don't even recognize the delivery company, so I'm kind of like, have they just like handed it to a random courier, and that courier is just like lobbed it over a fence somewhere? Which I really hope not, because I bought the collector's edition and it's £80. I kind of want that. Yeah, I kind of want all that, you know, anime trash merchandise on my desk at work, but hey-ho.
But shall we go in age order or name order? Who wants to talk about their games first?
So this week I've been kind of on an ARPG kick with Wolcen, Lords of Mayhem coming out. I played that a bit. I had the server issues and stuff trying to play with my couple of people I play with, so I ended up playing Grim Dawn instead, which has all those expansion packs, and I think Grim Dawn's a really nice game. So I was trying out some old ARPGs, living out the Diablo 2 fantasy from my childhood. That's why ARPGs always give me, is because they trigger that Diablo 2 memory.
Fair enough. We've actually had David Brevik on the show twice.
Oh, that's cool.
Very cool.
It's awesome.
He's a very nice person.
We've both had a pretty busy week. I actually ended up on Reddit this week looking on game suggestions, our game suggestions, looking for anybody who knew a game like Tenchu Stealth Assassin, which was a game I played.
And now I want to go and find that thread to see what you were told. And
now I want to go play Tenchu Stealth Assassin because Tenchu is incredible.
Good game, yeah. So looking for someone who knew any game that was like it. I've looked at Origami and Mark the Ninja so far. A couple of suggestions. I'll post the link to you guys. But it's hard to beat. I don't know. That's probably a mix of nostalgia from the first, I think that was on PS1. And then that game was just so good. So been looking for a clone.
I think that's the thing, is like you want something that doesn't just capture, because like Sekiro, for example, is meant to be kind of a spiritual successor because it started as one. But like you want that cheesy, I want the cheesy voice acting, I want the cheesy, like weird animations they had going on. It's just,
And it was a very refined, clean gameplay. There wasn't a lot to do other than be super stealthy. And I don't know. I haven't actually picked up Sekiro yet, but it looks like there's a lot of other big sword fighting stuff going on, which Tenshu was just, if you peeved the guards off, then that was sort of the end of it. if you couldn't get on a rooftop and get away. So I don't know. Yeah. It's a hard thing to reproduce, but.
Okay, well, let's start asking some questions about this Kickstarter and this Cyber Knights Flashpoint. First, tell us a bit about yourselves.
Well, my name is Corey, and I'm the technical director at Tracy Brothers. I work on the programming and a lot of the design for our upcoming title, Cyber Knights, and as well for our previous titles, Star Traders Frontiers and Templar Battle Force. And then my brother, my partner, is Andrew. What do you work on, Andrew?
I'm the other half of the equation, generally manage the creative direction and do story writing for the company. So the two of us have worked kind of as a duo on all, I think the number is 8 release games, and we're working on our 9th game now. So we've always been sort of the very heart of the Tracy Brothers design team. So that's our split of the work.
Yeah, full disclosure, I've been playing your game since Star Traders RPG and pledged to your last 2 Kickstarters.
Thank you for your support.
Awesome.
You've played our game since like 2011 or something.
Yep.
Amazing.
I kept Star Traders installed on my phone, and then upgraded my phone, so reinstalled it, and every so often there'd be an update for it, and it's like this is a 5-year-old game and you're still updating it.
That's a labor of love. I mean, I still have Star Traders RPG on my phone, and sometimes when I need to kill time on a train or something, I'll play that just because, like Nikki said, sometimes you just need like something that's totally simple on a little tiny screen. You're just like going to mash some buttons for a while. Like, I don't want to play a complex game right now. I just want to zone out for 10 minutes. And, I still play it like that.
So how big is the team at Trace Brothers?
We work with a number of different partners that we've used over and over for the last game. So I think right now, the current headcount of people working on Cyber Knights is 10. We've grown a lot over the years. And we started pulling in additional team members to help us with things as far back as Age of Pirates, so 5 games ago. And have just kept growing those partnerships over the years. So we're really excited to have the biggest and strongest team yet working on our new game.
And Cyber Knights is our first 3D title, so it takes more staff. A lot of those headcount are art team members doing texturing or hard surface modeling or animation rigging for the new game. Star Traders was a 2D game. Primarily, there's some like 2.5D stuff in there, but the art requires a lot less headcount. So one of the reasons we have a little bigger team and we're back on Kickstarter right now is to try and beef up that art budget to buy a bit more time with this art team and get even more, visual variety into the game.
Right. So tell us about Cyber Knights Flashpoint.
In Cyber Knights, you take the role of a Cyber Knight, the eponymous role of a Cyber Knight that's a covert operator who's had a illegal and permanent quantum computer implanted in their spine, something you'll never have removed, and allows you to kind of run a team of thieves, hackers, and soldiers of fortune who start to work for the power players in this city. It's a cyberpunk game, so it plays into a lot of the kind of genre tropes that you might see in other cyberpunk. You're playing a mercenary working for, you know, criminal organizations, gang leaders, corrupt corporate agents, and doing their dirty work around the city, sabotaging each other, covering up things they shouldn't have been doing in order to get rich, die trying, or find a way maybe to get out of this deadly game that you're in.
It's kind of a combination of Neuromancer and Johnny Mnemonic. You know, those are some of the big source material stuff. Gibson, you know, is kind of one of the founding fathers of modern cyberpunk. And we looked at a lot of some of the plots and characters and tropes that are present in that work. And then there's a lot of other big inspirations. You know, you've got obviously this Cyberpunk 2020, Shadowrun, just kind of filling out the cyberpunk lexicon.
And that's from, I think we've addressed it pretty well from a lore standpoint. From a gameplay standpoint, it's a turn-based tactics RPG. You are the leader of a squad. You pick a subset of your squad to go on missions into these corporate facilities or down into gang territory. You're, you know, capturing someone, killing someone, stealing a prototype, hacking a mainframe. And you run these missions in a mix of turn-based tactics with both stealth, hacking, and combat all sort of on the table. And then between the missions, you and your team are camped out back at your safe house somewhere, hidden in the city, kind of crafting on weapons, making phone calls to your contacts, setting up meetings, arranging the new mission, the next mission. So it's got a kind of there's a very XCOM feel to that base and mission rhythm of the game, but with a lot of really unique and different elements that fit the genre.
Okay. You mentioned, Corey, the style is quite different to your past games. What prompted the move to the third dimension?
Well, to tell the story of Cyber Knights, we really want to be able to let the character, or the player, sorry, get really closely familiar with their character. So Star Traders is a game where you have like a larger crew, and there's some standout heroes that you know really well, and you pay close attention to their personalities and their traits. But there's a large crew. You're a captain of a starship. But Cyber Knights, we wanted to give the player this very, you know, personal feeling of having a small family of mercenaries, their hand-picked company, kind of their A-team only. So one of the things we really wanted to be able to do was give the player a huge amount of customization of this tight-knit group that they were forming. They were hiring off the streets and training and augmenting and getting through scrapes and healing from wounds. And so we really felt like 3D was, after doing Star Traders and its customization system, we really felt that 3D was going to give us a great canvas for expressing the characters and letting players configure them, having different outfits and augmentations show up and having different hairstyles compatible with armor. There's a lot of things that when you're building 2D skeletons, you just can't do. You can't get it to render, or there's rules with the layers or whatever. So there's a lot of stuff that's just off the table. 3D opens a lot more doors in terms of what you can let the player control and what you can show their characters doing.
That's interesting. I'm not a developer. I would have assumed that 2D would have been easier to show like customization options.
I mean, I think it's probably easier. Andrew would probably say that 2D was phenomenally easier to do, but your scope of what you can show is smaller.
Right.
And then I think the other thing is it lets us show the actual combat map in a way that's, you know, if you've played Templar Battle Force, the maps are essentially flat. There's no elevation. But with 3D, we can do all sorts of stuff with the maps where there's different elevations and cliffs and towers and sniper nests and all sorts of stuff that you really couldn't do with a flat map.
That's really interesting. You've already touched on this subject, but what are your inspirations for Cyber Knights?
Well, I do think from a world and story perspective, there's a lot of really...
really founding father kind of cyberpunk. Gibson is huge in there, and then Philip K. Dick behind Blade Runner, and those sorts of angles are all very, you know, things we grew up with. I always, you know, when talking with this about Corey, when we were prepping for the Kickstarter, both of us came back to a memory of having picked up the Johnny Mnemonic VHS tape, which here, at least stateside, it was bright orange, and it was the only colored VHS tape they ever made that I don't think I ever saw another one like it. It was such an odd thing, but it really stuck with me. It was maybe for me the first real cyberpunk thing I ever encountered, with the amazing Keanu Reeves. And so I think, you know, so we lean on a lot of those really things that sort of like we're talking about Tenchu earlier, you encounter those things early and really fall in love with some of them, and then are looking to recapture not the exact thing, but the feeling, the emotional connection, and the kind of the experience of those first encounters.
Is there any significance behind the choice of year 2231?
Well, we set it a little bit in the future from the first game in the series. So, you know, one of the things that we take a lot of inspiration from is our experience playing pen and paper role-playing games in the cyberpunk universes that we've built. So Cyber Knights as a setting started as like a homebrew pen and paper game that we would play around a kitchen table with our friends. And we would, this is the same story. You were a bunch of mercenaries working for the highest bidder, getting betrayed by corporations and trying to survive. But we told a lot of stories that we really liked telling, and we really liked some of the ways that it drew characters in, this, you know, the betrayal and the survival. And we found that to be a big inspiration for Cyber Knights. And talking about it, that was some of the stuff that we wanted to use in the game as we built it out. Not sure I answered your question.
I think another cool thing, a little bit different in Cyber Knights, is that the date, you know, the actual exact date, 2231, isn't perhaps so important to us, but that it is roughly 200 years in the future, which gives us some more leeway to really imagine that a bigger events have passed, right? If you're 22 or 20, 50, or I think some of their, like, some really interesting dates passing right now, like, I don't remember exactly what it was, but something was set, you know, Cyberpunk 2020 this year, Blade Runner 2020, you know, they were looking a little bit farther in the future and imagining a big, all the changes that could happen. And by looking out 200 years, we're looking at a point where environmental collapse has already happened. Technology has, quantum computing is in, artificial consciousness have been created, murdered and outlawed, and humanity already has like colonies and space stations kind of dotting the solar system. So it allows us to have a bit more of a wider vision of what the future might look like, even though as humanity we may not have gotten all that far, but we've done a lot, you know, a lot of things have changed in more bigger ways than if we were to set it close to the current date, we would feel a little more restricted.
That's interesting. Unrelated to gaming, there's a Marvel universe that's set in 2099. They created it in the 90s, and they've actually gone back to it recently and kind of updated it, because obviously it's a lot closer now than it was back then. So they've changed the way technology appears and
that's really interesting.
I thought that was quite interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it's a moving target, like predicting the future. And I think one of the things we wanted to do was have a setting that we could define sort of as we did with the pen and paper games. And putting it far enough in the future really lets you tell a story that's detached from maybe the today, but also, you know, can use some of the things that the scary predictions of the future that you see today, like the ice caps will be gone in 100 years. So like, let's tell a story about 100 years after the ice caps are gone. You know, the world's completely messed up. How are people still surviving, you know, and clinging to the planet in that setting?
One of the questions I've written down is why did you decide to go back to Kickstarter? You've already explained that you wanted a bigger budget for all these 3D artists you've brought on.
I think it's twofold. Go ahead, Andrew.
Yeah, we are back for budget for sure. We want funding. We have self-funded this game from the sales of other games, all of our previous titles. So we have come to the Kickstarter with a lot of the funding for the game already secured. And what we came to Kickstarter for was to help us expand what we could do ourselves. So we're looking to get more visual variety, more weapon types, more environments, all sorts of things like that that can make the game deeper and give us room to really express even more things. On top of that, there are two other really key things that we're trying to get out of Kickstarter. The first is the alpha team. So for every one of our games since Age of Pirates, which I think was game number 4, we have always run a closed alpha for our games, which is alpha maybe a little, it's our word for it. We open up the game to a small community of players when the game is cooked enough to be a lot of fun, but not finished baking so much that we can't make major changes. And we work for usually a couple of months. I think Star Trader's alpha ran almost 8 months to work with those players and update the game constantly based on their feedback, roll in new content, and really improve the game on all sorts of levels. So the Kickstarter is one of our ways of getting, or is our way of getting that crew together. We have about 500 people in the alpha right now, and we're trying to get up to about 700 is what we're shooting for right now. We've got a drive going on the Kickstarter to get to the savage 700, we're calling it. And then the third thing we're looking, we always love to work with Kickstarter, especially as a story writer, the higher pledge rewards from 100 up, we are inviting backers to really start to put some of their own inspirations or ideas into the game, from like a random news clipping or a corrupted file you might find on a server you're hacking somewhere, with like conspiracy theories or weird legends or rumors, to putting names in the game for characters and weapons, to actually like helping create a character that all of the players in the game might meet and recruit, getting your face modeled into the game, creating like a huge villain or ally character who will have a big part to play in the story. So we love that kind of Kickstarter connection, to let people create things into the game, and we help fit it into the world in a way that feels really cohesive. It's been, for me, one of my favorite things about the last two Kickstarters we've run successfully. Those creations are often some of the things that other players love the most, and they're always asking about where they came from or what inspirations we had. And we can say, you know, a lot of this stuff came from really creative Kickstarter backers.
How does this Kickstarter differ from the ones you've run in the past?
Well, it's been 5 years, so we've definitely tried to improve the overall quality of the Kickstarter in terms of it, how it's actually executed, you know, from a business perspective, doing a better job, offering better, simpler rewards, having a better video, more gifts. But, you know, in general, it's not a whole lot different than what we've done before. We want to get a little bit more budget so that we can show off our collaborators a little better. We can have our composer write a few more songs. We can have our art team draw or model a few more things. We assemble our alpha team. This one does, I think, have some unique things to it, because our community has been asking us for Cyber Knights for a while. They've been asking us to make this game for years. So I think it's special to us from that perspective, but I think compared to Star Traders, it might be a better campaign, but spiritually it's like the same, kind of the same idea. We really want to work with our community to make another game. We love their creative input, and the last game would not have won any awards without the alpha. I can say that 100%. Like, if we hadn't had the alpha team to help us,
figure out what was good and what was not good and filter through, you know, the way the game was going to fit together, I don't think it would have been anywhere near as good as it ended up being. The alpha team was so valuable.
Fantastic. How did it feel when you passed your funding goal in just 12 hours?
That was really exciting. It was very exciting. We were really hyped about it. Really happy for our community as well. Like the people that were really excited and hopeful that the game was going to be made and big fans. They were, I think, some of the people on our Discord were as excited or more excited than we were. But we were overjoyed. It's really honorable. It's a big honor to have people trust you with their money, that they think they can give you money and that you'll be able to deliver something that they've only seen parts of. And especially now, Kickstarter is increasingly, you know, littered with campaigns that didn't complete, that funded but never delivered. There were campaigns that were run concurrently with Star Traders Frontiers that you know, nothing ever came of them. So it's an honor that people, you know, look at your track record and say, these guys are trustworthy, this company is trustworthy, I'd back this project. So it feels really good.
Anything to add, Andrew?
I mean, I think we knew the community really wanted to make this for a long time. They've been telling us, but Kickstarter is one of those funny black boxes. You can do all the prep work and get mailing lists and people will tell you they're going to back it and all these things, but you just don't know what happens until the clock starts ticking and you push the button. So it was really, I think, same thing with the community. They just didn't know, you know. So we were all sort of sitting there collectively on the edge of our seats. It was so super excited to see just how many people were waiting. You know, there was like a hilarious race to get the first pledge in. You know, it was a bonkers experience. But you kind of, that day was pretty nerve-wracking because you just don't know, you know, what's actually going to happen. So it was a relief and super excited to see how it went.
Okay. Since this, you've got several other games out, are you implementing any Easter eggs in Cyber Knights?
Yeah, we always try to have a few callbacks, Easter eggs. And then because we have Kickstarter backers, we can't really get around having Easter eggs. Because if we refuse to put them in, then Kickstarter backers will use their backer rewards to put in their own Easter eggs. Like, it's guaranteed. Like, if we don't put in Star Traders, inside Star Traders jokes hidden somewhere in Cyber Knights, and they still might, you know, they still might. They'll be like, my guy's name is, you know, Estelle. And you're like, okay. Like, is she an arbiter? And they're like, yes. So, you know, there's always a lot of there's a lot of fun to be had when you have, you know, when you have different universes to use. So we'll see some Easter eggs, we'll see some callbacks, and we always like to say thank you to, you know, the people that have really helped us are, you know, people like yourself that have been with us for a long time, backed multiple times. You know, there's little Easter eggs in a lot of our games that say thank you to backers, people who, you know, we name things after them, or there's little plot, inside plot jokes. They're all over Star Traders. I mean, so I think that's one of the fun things about getting to make games with your brothers. You get, you know, if you're in a big studio and there's 1,000 people working on the game, sneaking Easter egg or an inside joke in, you know, it's kind of hard because it's very serious. But Andrew and I, we're like, this is hilarious. We ask community, is this funny? They're like, yep, that's funny. They're like, it's going in. You know?
Okay. Which feature would you add if time and budget restraints weren't a thing?
Personally, so I'll give you the art answer. I mean, we have time and budget are always a thing. So we've worked really hard with the art team to maximize our ability to do visual customizations of characters. Style and looking cool and having the right glasses and the coolest haircut is such a cyberpunk thing. But we have all, you know, you're always bumping up against limitations. So if we had additional budget, I would love to be able to do way more with the cybernetic side of things. There will be a good deal of visual outward
manifestation of cybernetics that you put, that your character has installed. Cyber arms, cyber chin, your eyes, ear replacements, all sorts of things. But I personally visually would just love to have additional budget to really get into all of the really cool things that you could do that express sort of the world and how brutal cyberware can be. I always look at Elysium as a movie that had such cool cybernetic and tech in it. So anyway, my vote would be to spend the money on the art budget and to make things even cooler in terms of cyberware. I don't know what Corey says.
Like unlimited budget, I think I would, and I don't, I mean, we're never going to have this much money, but I would make the safe house attackable. The player has like this base they build where they have their little clinic and their weapons shop and stuff. And we might have one story based, you know, scenario where it gets attacked, but you know, it's not a combat map and it doesn't have any of, it's not going to have any of the stuff that it would need to be a fightable, fun map. But I would, you know, given $1 million, I'd probably make it so the bad guys could like storm your base at any time and you'd always be worried about your base getting attacked.
So your answer would be add stressful things to the game.
Yes, increase difficulty, add stressful things. Yeah. And I might make it so like you know, more bad things could happen to your characters. Like maybe instead of all these customization Andrew's talking about, like how about we make the art team render all the grievous injuries that your mercs could take? This guy's only got half a face because he took a grenade. That was in Elysium, wasn't it, Andrew? You said you liked that movie.
Yeah, I did.
I do think we have a nice budget. Kickstarter is going to help. Our last game was reasonably successful, and we've taken that and kind of betted on Cyber Knights, so to speak. So I think we're going to have a budget to make the game that we want to make. But that's a great question. That's, you know, another, you know, no budget, probably be co-op. Like, I love playing games with my friends. Making games you can play multiplayer well with two people, it's pretty tough. But co-op might be on my like, blue sky list.
Okay, what's one feature that you really hope players are going to enjoy?
I think one of the things that Cyber Knights is doing differently than other games in the genre is to use a more fluid movement and action point system, where it takes a, there's definitely inspiration, you know, we're turn-based tactics, so you can't be too far from XCOM and games like it. You know, you know that your lineage goes back to that in some regard, but Cyber Knights will have a much more flexible action point system. You'll have a pool of action points and you'll be able to take more actions during your turn than just two, for example. And also we're getting away from the grid, which allows us to remove a lot of the kind of approximation elements in classic turn-based games that can be kind of frustrating at times. Like a grenade, the explosion and damage from a grenade isn't approximated to tiles. It's actually based on exact measurements and meters and things like that, and has a fall off outside of the explosion radius. If you're a meter outside of that, it's not that you get absolutely zero damage. You are still very close to a grenade and you're going to be affected by it. So I think those two for me are super exciting to see them in action. I think people are going to really, I hope, really like them because it gets away from some of the stuff that I think a lot of us who love turn-based tactics games get pretty frustrated with on a grid. Like, my grenade is so close to you, how can I not at least do some damage, for example.
I think one of the things I'm really excited about for Cyber Knights is bringing the traits and traits mutation system into Cyber Knights. We used it in Star Traders Frontiers and players really liked it there, and I think we can enhance it and make a cooler version of it for Cyber Knights. It's a great feeling when your characters sort of develop personalities based on the things that you do. If you run a sneaky, stealthy, operation where it's clean and by the numbers, and your mercenaries develop traits like precise and perfect timing, and they sort of train into and mutate into people that are like what they do, which is sort of how the real world works. Or if you run a super crazy squad, your mercs end up with brute and bloodthirsty and bruiser. So they're tough and they're violent and they have those personality traits, and that's how they act because that's how you have them behave, on the mission. So I think that's really fun, and you get a feeling like the game's customizing itself to your choices. And the story, of course, will have like lots of additional things where you're choosing, between two shades of gray. It's cyberpunk, so it's not like good or evil, but you're making choices that have morality impacts and could impact your characters and their traits. And I think players will really enjoy that, especially given the smaller nature of the Cyber Knights mercenary team, like that you have less people to keep track of. There's a great example in one of the Star Traders reviews where somebody's favorite character gets like terribly shot up in a fight and they almost die and they end up xenophobic, like terrified of the aliens. And then they spend too much time in the spice hall because their morale is always going down. So they become a spice addict. And it's just like this story of like the slow loss of this guy's favorite character. But then he's like 10 out of 10 would lose my best friend again in outer space. And it's like, it doesn't always go bad, but when it goes bad, it makes sense. You're like, okay, I almost got him killed. So then he had this problem where he had to go to the spice hall and he was always in the cups, and then he became an addict, and then he couldn't fight anymore, and like I had to fire him. But it's like, it lets you tell a story that's like based on your actions and what's happening in the game, what you're doing. And I think some people really like those kind of stories.
And of course you have, some of those stories end and they found a specialist doctor and put the dude in a vat tank for 2 months, and he came out without his fear of Xenos anymore and went back into battle. So some of that stuff, there's as Corey said, there's positives and negative directions, but it helps you tell a story that is more directly linked to your actions and has this history of your actions kind of imprinted into the people that went through them with you. So you can look back in your squad or your crew and see the echoes of what you all did together in their character sheets. So personally, that is another huge one. I think it'll be great to bring that forward.
Okay. Last question I've got written down is, there's dogs in the game. Can you pet them?
not quite yet, but very soon. We have a stretch goal at 140 grand. That's an animation expansion. We're going to use the funding there to kind of blow out. We've got a pretty good budget for the game. We have all the animations we really feel like we had to have. And this
for the shooting, for the main shooting part, yeah, you got all those
shooty, sneaky, that sort of stuff. And if we can get up to that stretch goal, which we're closing in on it now, we are going to add petting the dog. We're going to add, things like dragging bodies around. We're going to add some additional beefed up transitions between different animations so that going from running to cover looks cooler.
Popping
popping in and out of cover. And we're going to add some additionally fun safe house animations so that when your mercs are wandering around your safe house, you can, they have more like animated things that they can do to look at home. So we're very close. Help share the word if you want to pet the dog in the video game. This is definitely the one for you. We just need a bit more. We're on our way. We're 134 right now, so getting close.
And if we hit it, the Discord backer people have already demanded that we add an Easter egg that like lets you click the dog a bunch and it makes someone come over and pet the dog. It won't just be passive. There'll be some hidden way you can get people to pet the dog, bang its crate, or
the Twitter account "Can you pet the dog?" is going to be very happy if you meet that stretch goal.
They were kind enough to retweet us early in the campaign, and they're
good people.
very awesome. Great. Yeah.
I love game. We love game memes. You know, we've got a lot of press F for respect and can you pet the dog and a lot of love for gaming memes. So,
right. Well, thank you for joining us and talking about the game. You can find it on Kickstarter. I'll include a link in the show notes and make sure to add it to your Steam wish list. That always helps developers.
Absolutely. Wishlisting games you're interested in, super important. Ours or anybody else's. Helps Steam know what you're into and helps a lot. Yeah, wishlisting's great.
Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having us. It was great to be on, and we really appreciate both you and Nikki talking to us today.
Really interesting to listen to you talk, and all the best with the rest of the development.
Yeah, hopefully go for it.
Good luck finding some time to play some games this week. And have you, I hope you're able to carve out a few hours for something you love.
Thank you again for Corey and Andrew. Make sure you check out Cyber Knight's Flashpoint. Right, our news today. We've got a few things to quickly run through because we're getting on in the episode. Activision Blizzard have pulled all of their games from GeForce Now a week after launch, apparently due to a misunderstanding. Call of Duty, I thought it was just Modern Warfare, but it appears it may have been more than that. World of Warcraft, Overwatch were available during the beta period, but the publisher demanded the games be removed, and they obviously have been. If you missed our discussion on it last week, week before, GeForce Now is a streaming service. You link in your accounts to it, and like Steam and at one point Activision Blizzard, and it lets you stream your games that you own to any device, like your phone. You could play Destiny 2 on your phone for an hour at a time on the free plan, or 6 hours at a time on the paid plan.
Wait. So even if you pay, there's a limit to how much you can actually play?
Yes. Paying gives you 6 hours on it, and then puts you to the front of the queue. Because obviously there's limited space, so you have to queue. And if you pay, you queue faster.
Well, okay. Full disclosure, this is the first I've actually properly looked into this. What? Like, I know, I get that. I do understand that, because I know I tried to use PlayStation Now at one point, and it was like, you are 106th in the queue to play this game. And I was like, wait, what? Like, I get that, because it's streaming services. I get, you know, it makes sense. But that's weird that you pay and they still... Yeah, I don't know. I digress.
PlayStation Now you pay and they still make you... They don't have a free tier, at least.
They do. It's just called a PlayStation. this is kind of funny, to be honest with you, the fact that, like, this has happened. There is an update on the story with NVIDIA clarifying that apparently it was due to a misunderstanding, which is why the games were originally included. So, they're like, oh, Activision were a fantastic partner. We just got to recognize this as a misunderstanding. We've removed the games from our service. We hope we can work with them to re-enable these and more in the future.
I wondered if it was an issue with, somewhere in Blizzard's terms and conditions, there's going to be something that says you're not allowed to share your login details for World of Warcraft. But is that harder for them to enforce if you're giving someone your GeForce Now login details?
Potentially. There is also that argument around, so I know some of their games require you have a constant online connection, I know, to access all features, so it's possible that maybe there's a whole ream of reasons that this could have happened. I'm going to just settle on the fact that it's just Activision. I'm not really surprised, but like, yeah, I'm sure, to be honest with you, your suggestion is quite a good one. I would be curious to know, but yeah, this is a weird service, because you're having to give all your login details to them, and then if... Huh.
Our next news story concerns the price of the upcoming PlayStation 5. Apparently, Sony is struggling with the price due to costly parts, including the RAM. And apparently, the manufacturing costs for the next PlayStation are around $450 per unit. Back in the days of the PlayStation 3, they sold that at a loss of well over $100 per unit because it was costing them like $600 per unit, and they were selling them for $450 to $500 each.
If I remember, though, with the PS4, they didn't sell it at a loss. Or well, according to this article, they sold it at a $10 profit. It cost them $10 less than the retail price. An interesting thing that someone pointed out to me about this, though, is this is $450 for manufacture. This doesn't account, if this report is to be believed, this doesn't account for things like packaging, distribution, shipping, like all the other stuff that comes into releasing a product. So potentially, this value is a lot higher. You could probably be quite comfortable saying around $550 to $600 per unit when you factor in everything. Obviously, you know, when you've got a ship full of PlayStation 5s being moved around the world, the cost per unit is a lot cheaper rather than posting one at a time. But still, that's something that has to be factored in. I personally can't see Sony going higher than $450. I know there's reports going around that they're waiting to see what Microsoft do with the new Xbox and their pricing so they can undercut them. But I also think it's not necessarily that. It's more because they're using similar hardware, they're probably curious to see how they mark it up. But I think going higher than $450 would be completely suicidal.
This report says that the console would have to be at least $470. That would be a hard sell to consumers, considering the Sony's most expensive machine now is the $400 PS4 Pro, and is often discounted. But that's not taking into account, as I mentioned before, the PlayStation 3 was about $500.
Yeah, potentially, like, it's worth bearing in mind that something they could always do, and have console manufacturers have done this in the past, is there's, you know, they release a console, they sell it at a loss, then they come out with a newer version that's cheaper. You know, the PS4...
Like the PlayStation 3, which wasn't backwards compatible with the PlayStation 2 after the first run.
Yeah, but they didn't cut the price by like $100/pounds.
Don't recall the specifics, but yeah, it was cheaper.
Yeah, and you know, like how the PS4, you had the PS4, and then you had the PS4 Slim, and the PS4 Pro. Obviously, the Pro was a jump up because of what it is, but the statement still stands that potentially, who knows, it buying a console day one is a hard thing to sell to any consumer, so price is key, but it's more, I think, how they line up for success over the first year of sales, because I know I bought my PS4, I think I bought it when Destiny came out. Or just after. It was within the first year of the console being out, and the price had already been discounted a fair bit. So a lot of people may wait, so maybe if they just undercut themselves. I don't know. I'm not obviously very good at the economy or business. But yeah, I think $450 is... I don't know. It's a weird one as well, because everyone's kind of banging on about this $450 now, so it's like, well, if they suddenly came out and said, actually, it's $500, people might pull the, oh, you lied to us, when they've actually said nothing. This is just weird reports that people are throwing out. All of this could be completely wrong. For all we know, it's actually only costing them $300 to manufacture each unit. Who knows? Sony know, and hopefully they'll tell us, like, soon. Because, I mean, I'd like a PS5 on release, if it's good, but, you know...
I mean, if the next iteration of the PlayStation 5 is not going to be backwards compatible with the 4, 3, 2, and 1, then yeah, I want that first run. But speaking of things that are getting another run, Persona 5 Royal. It's come out during the preview event that certain scenes, specifically involving Ryuji and two homosexuals, is going to be changed when it comes west, so that they're no longer shown in a negative light. When if you played Persona 5, at one point you come across these two gents, and they're quite openly sexual towards Ryuji, and the protagonist can egg them on, and it's a bit weird because Ryuji is a minor, so Atlas, there's translation team, localization team, is apparently very on the pulse about what's right and what to do. And this is their chance to make it right. Why didn't they make it right the first time? Perhaps they didn't have this internal content review team.
Yeah.
For Persona 5.
This is something that I think we've talked about before. Listeners who may recall the discussion we had around Catherine Full Body Edition. And if you're a long-term fan of any of the Persona games or any of Atlas's recent games, like, to be quite blunt, they don't handle LGBTQ plus themes very well. And you could also argue, why are they there? And there is an argument to be had that any representation is better than no representation, but at the same time, it's like, but if it's just being included to poke fun at it, then why is it there? Anyway, credit to the localization team. I think it's important to really emphasize, because I've seen some hate going to them for like, oh, they're censoring the game. No, they're doing the right thing, I think, at this point. And addressing a scene which honestly is kind of just weird. Yeah, again, minor. But I always have to remind myself and others that obviously, you know, these games are made in Japan. They are made by Japanese developers. Obviously, cultural and cultural differences in the way things are perceived. For those who don't know, Japan has a bit of a rocky kind of setting with LGBTQ stuff. So,
unless it's in Dojoshin.
Yeah. But this is the thing, is this argument, the conversation around this isn't, why is this being censored? It's, why is it there in the first place? This scene arguably has it adds nothing to the game. It has no, you know, no real weight behind it, other than the fact that it's just there to make fun at the expense of a minority, which it's this weird thing of like, the localization team are doing good work, but like, localization shouldn't be there to bandage up your mistakes. This sort of thing should be stomped down at the developer level. And if they're going to add these kind of things and try and have moments where they poke fun at, if they're poking fun at something, it should just be gone. But if they want to tackle things like LGBTQ subjects, then they should do it respectfully and actually, you know, put time and money into it. I refer back to Persona 4, which has slightly more in that. If anyone remembers Kanji, then, you know, okay. Arguably handled better, but not perfect. So, you know, Atlas could probably do some really cool representation if they actually seem to care. They don't seem to care. They seem to include things as kind of a throwaway joke at their own, you know, at the expense of others, for whatever few people enjoy it. And it's kind of just annoying. I still haven't played Persona 5. I was going to get Persona 5 Royal, but you know what? I'm actually sick and tired of Atlas and their LGBTQ sort of harassment, really. Not harassment's maybe a bit far, but like, they keep poking fun at the community for no reason. And it's just kind of like, no, fuck off. So, yeah, this is really disappointing to hear, but now I'm really glad the localization team are stomping out. But again, localization shouldn't be fixing these problems. These problems shouldn't exist in the first place.
Well said.
Thank you. It's like I kind of thought about it before I said it.
On a lighter note to end the podcast, we mentioned a few weeks ago that Stadia had, Google Stadia had gone a bit quiet since release, and now, well, they announced that they're releasing more games, and now they're releasing Stadia on more phones. Before, it was only available on the Pixel, so that is obviously a limited selection of users, but now it's going to be across the Samsung Galaxy line from S8 through S10 and the upcoming S20, or I say upcoming, has it actually come out? I've seen tweets about it from Samsung, not from people, so I don't know if anyone actually has hands on them. But another, you can also use the Razer Phone, Razer Phone 2, and listeners of the podcast will be familiar with the Asus ROG Phone 2, the ROG Phone 2. We had a member of the team on the podcast at the start of the year to talk about it. And there's a review of the ROG Phone 2 on GameGreen.com. Obviously, this update hasn't rolled out. It's rolling out on February the 20th. So we did not have access to it when we were reviewing the ROG Phone 2.
I kind of find it amusing that this is even a thing. It's cool. I know I'm not exactly the most enthusiastic about streaming of games, but I find it amusing that Stadia have had this really weird sort of PR run since launching where they've kind of blamed developers for not getting on the platform and like things like that. And then suddenly they're just like, you can play on your phone. Doesn't really change anything. It's cool. It's nice to have. You can play in your web browser. You can play on pretty much anything that has an internet connection. That's kind of what Stadia is supposed to do. That the fact I can play on my phone, if I happened to own one of these phones, I do not, because I own a OnePlus, would it make me change my mind and get Stadia? No. Is anyone even still using Stadia? I know people that bought the Founders Pack used it for like an hour and have already packed it away.
Oh, crikey. I do not know anyone personally who plays on one. A member of GameGreen staff does have one. I haven't spoken to them about it.
Yeah, I mean, again, like it's. I'm sure it works fine and it's good. I hate to be the one on the podcast that's a constant downer about streaming. But I just, yeah, I'm not. Nothing about Stadia excites me.
And on that note, we've reached the end of our podcast. Thank you for joining me, Nikki. You can find her on Twitter at @error_Nikki, myself on @AceLister, if you want to see what we tweet about. Utter nonsense, I can guarantee. Thank you for listening, and an even bigger thank you for subscribing, whether it's via Spotify, iTunes, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or our RSS feed. You can leave a review on iTunes, follow us on Spotify, or post a cheeky comment on GameGreen.com. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, and Twitch too. And while you're at it, game on.